Hello, and welcome to ALSPathways.ca Healthcare Provider Podcast Series. My name is Dr. Hannah Capinto, and I am a general neurologist in the Greater Toronto Area. I'm joined today by Dr. Lauren Zinman, Director of the ALS and Neuromuscular Clinic at Sunnybrook Hospital in Toronto, Associate Professor of U of T, and we will be your co-hosts for this educational podcast. Welcome, Dr. Zinman.
Hello, it's good to be with you.
We're here today to talk about the role general neurologists and other non-ALS specialists play in the identification and diagnosis of ALS and key challenges we may be facing in this process. Dr. Zinman will be answering some important questions and sharing some of his practical tips from his experience and how we can close the diagnostic gap that currently exists for patients that have been diagnosed with ALS.
Thank you again for taking the time to discuss ALS with me, Dr. Pinto. I really welcome any opportunity to increase awareness for this awful disease.
So, Dr. Zinman, let's start from the beginning. Remind us, what is ALS?
So ALS stands for amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. It's really a pathological description of this awful disease described by Charcot back in the 18th century. It's a progressive degenerative motor neuron disease characterized by the degeneration of upper motor neurons and lower motor neurons. The upper motor neurons are the motor neurons that start in your motor cortex and extend down the spinal cord. And the lower motor neurons are the neurons that extend out of the spinal cord and innervate your muscles. As these motor neurons degenerate, they result in weakness and muscle wasting in the arms and legs. They result in speech and swallowing difficulties. And it can also result in difficulty breathing, which eventually causes death. Most patients survive about 2 to 5 years from symptom onset. And although we have some interventions to slow down the disease progression, we cannot stop this awful disease, and there remains no cure. ALS is an extremely challenging disease to diagnose, and typically it takes about 1.5 to 2 years from symptom onset to diagnosis.
Wow, so that sounds like a really long time. And I think this would be the major challenge that we as general neurologists also run into. So that brings us to our next point. So tell us about the diagnosis and the journey itself. Tell us why it takes so long. What causes the delays and the challenges that we're facing in the diagnostic process, both from a healthcare perspective, just in the system, and at the level of community neurology practice?
ALS is a complex and rare neuromuscular disease, so it's not the first thing people will think of when they present with the first symptom. It only occurs in about 2 to 3 per 100,000 individuals, and in the early phase of the disease, where it hasn't disseminated throughout the body, it's very complicated to diagnose. It's also quite heterogeneous. It can start in the arms, it can start in the legs, it can start in the speech and swallowing areas, or it can start with breathing difficulties. We also don't have a diagnostic biomarker, such as a blood test, like patients with diabetes, where you can just do a simple blood test, then you have your diagnosis. For ALS, it's a diagnosis of exclusion, and you have to cross off all these other potential mimickers before you arrive at a diagnosis. To make a diagnosis, you need symptoms and signs of motor neuron damage that spreads over time and over body region. As we said, it typically takes a few years before a patient ultimately is given this diagnosis of ALS because it's not obvious in the earliest phase of the disease before it disseminates.
So this point's well taken then. So it certainly sounds like there's multiple levels at which it could be not as apparent in the early stages, especially with the primary care physician, who's usually the first person to evaluate the patient for their presenting complaint. And I agree, from a heterogeneous presentation perspective, in my experience, it's always been that these patients have been referred initially for a query stroke or maybe a cervical radiculopathy. I've even had cases where it could be caused a conversion disorder because the bulbar symptoms are just not a familiar pattern. So certainly, I think recognition of that at an early stage is definitely tough.
I think that's such an important point that you mentioned, because things like stroke or cervical or lumbosacral radiculopathies are so much more common than ALS. Then you're right, that is the appropriate first thing to think of. But when the investigations come back negative, then you got to think of something rarer like ALS.
So this leads me to my next question. Tell us a little bit more about practical ways to close this diagnostic gap. What are the key demographic details do general neurologists need to know about ALS?
So as I said, ALS is not common. It occurs in about 2 to 3 people per 100,000. That's sort of the annual incidence. And most people are diagnosed with a median age of in their late 50s or early 60s. But it does have a broad range of ages of presentation. We even sadly diagnose some people in their 20s with this awful disease. In general, the risk of ALS increases with age. Males tend to be slightly more affected than females, but this disease can affect anybody, any ethnic group, and any geographic population. 10% of the time, ALS runs in families. And when it does this, we call this familial ALS or falls. And it's usually passed along through family members in an autosomal dominant fashion, meaning half of the family members have it. So these patients typically come in and they say that I know what I had. My mother had this, my uncle had this, my cousins have had this. Luckily, that's only 10% of cases. 90% of cases, there's no family history, and we call this sporadic ALS, and we really don't know why they get this disease. There are some risk factors. We know that smoking slightly increases your risk of ALS, male sex, as we mentioned, and age. So as the older you get, the higher the risk of getting the disease. But for the most part, we don't know why these patients with sporadic ALS get this disease.
Given how rare it is, let's talk about some of the signs and symptoms that, as general neurologists, we need to be looking out for in that first step where we're triaging patients when we get the referral from their general practitioner. What should we be looking for in that referral to sort of quote-unquote red flag for us that these patients need to be seen urgently? Is there anything that should set up, you know, something for as general neurologists that this patient may have ALS just from receiving the referral letter?
I think that's a really good point, you know, when to expedite, you know, the referral or the appointment for a patient, given that most neurologists are very busy and have long waiting lists. What type of red flags can you look out for? And I think the kind of things you look out for is progressive arm or leg weakness in the absence of any pain or sensory symptoms. While it is possible to have a bad radiculopathy and not have any radicular pain, the vast majority of patients will have some sensory symptoms when they have a bad neck or a bad back that's contributing to their functional deficit. So I think that's the number one thing. Painless weakness is a warning sign. I think it's also important to look out for these patients with progressive speech difficulties who've already had a workup for stroke and there's no evidence of any abnormality on MRI. So progressive speech and swallowing difficulties with a normal CT scan or MRI brain, that's a red flag as well that patient should be seen sooner rather than later because it could be ALS. And then the most alarming of all are patients with progressive shortness of breath with no obvious respiratory cause. We call that sort of a restrictive pattern of breathing difficulty. That sort of triggers a neuromuscular cause. And those patients, they need to be seen as soon as possible, given that they already have respiratory compromise and they could have ALS or another mimicker. So I think those are the red flags that are important to look out for when a neurologist is going through the referrals from a primary care physician.
So I think the shortness of breath would certainly be something that, you know, as general neurologists, we don't come across as often. Generally, when I've had something like that referred to me, it's usually from a respirologist. So that's certainly interesting as a red flag. So Dr. Zinman, what about our first assessment appointment? As neurologists, what signs and symptoms should we be looking for to suspect ALS in a patient?
So remember, ALS is a disease of the upper motor neurons and lower motor neurons. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to see if there's a combination of upper motor neuron and lower motor neuron signs in multiple regions of the body. So for example, in the legs, we'd be looking for lower motor neuron sign, which is weakness, wasting, atrophy, fasciculations, along with upper motor neuron signs, which would be bris reflexes, spasticity, Babinski responses, those type of things. In the arms, it's very similar. Lower motor neuron signs with weakness, atrophy, wasting, fasciculations, concurrent with upper motor neuron signs, which would be the bris reflexes, finger jerks, Hoffman's, spasticity. In the bulbar region, the lower motor neuron sign would be tongue atrophy, tongue fasciculations, tongue weakness, and the upper motor neuron signs would be spastic speech, a brisk jaw jerk, pseudobulbar affect. So what you're trying to do is count whether there's upper motor neuron, lower motor neuron signs in the cervical. So I should start from the top in the bulbar, cervical, and lumbosacral regions. And if there are in three of those regions, we call that clinically definite ALS. In two regions, we call it clinically probable ALS. And in one region, we call it clinical possible ALS. And that's our LS-Gorrell diagnostic criteria. But you also have to make sure that there's no other etiologies. So before you can move forward with the diagnosis, you got to make sure the proper imaging was done to make sure there's no structural abnormality. And the disease has to progress. ALS doesn't stay the same. It progresses over time. So to summarize, upper motor neuron and lower motor neuron signs in multiple regions, a history of progression, and no other etiology found on investigations.
Okay. So if I understand you correctly, what we could be looking for, and I mean, in the early stages, would be, for example, a patient who's referred to us for something like a cervical radiculopathy has the attributable atrophy of the muscles, but at the same time has hyperreflexia that would be unlikely to be because of a cervical radiculopathy.
That's a really good point. Remember, in a cervical spondylotic myelopathy, which is a common imitator of ALS, and remember, cervical disease is very common, the patient would have lower motor neuron in the cervical region, and then potentially, if the spinal cord is involved, could have upper motor neuron signs below that level. In ALS, we want to make sure that the upper motor neuron signs are above the level of the lower motor neuron signs. So in those patients, we would expect there to be a spastic speech to help us with the diagnosis. But that's right. We're looking for both upper motor neuron and lower motor neuron signs in multiple regions that can't be explained by another etiology.
How can general neurologists best decide when to refer to an academic ALS neuromuscular center versus when should we be running more tests on our own?
Of course, anytime there's any concerns about ALS, there should not be a hesitation to refer to an ALS center. In Canada, we only have, 16 of these multidisciplinary ALS clinics across the country. And it's important that if it's a concern at all, then there shouldn't be any hesitation to refer. It is helpful, though, to initiate some of the investigations when you refer a patient. But I don't think you have to wait for the investigations to be completed. That's really up to the sort of the comfort and preference of the referring physician. Remember, you cannot diagnose ALS unless the proper neuroimaging has been performed. So if it's a patient with leg onset symptoms, certainly you'd want to make sure that MRI of the lumbar spine has been ordered. If it's a patient with arm weakness, cervical spine, and if it's a patient's presenting with bulbar symptoms, MRI brain should be ordered. And again, that can be ordered, and then the patient could be referred if the suspicion is quite high. There's always some basic blood work that's helpful to order, not just to look for potential mimickers, but also it's important to know that the blood work is normal before we can start patients on any medications for ALS and to enroll them into clinical trials. I think a pulmonary function test is always good to have at baseline, regardless if there are any respiratory complaints, because we know ALS can often affect the breathing muscles, and that's the main cause of death in this disease. So even if the breathing function is normal, arranging a baseline pulmonary function test is always extremely helpful for us.
So that point's well taken. Now, in triaging patients then with, forced vital capacities, would you also require referrals to other specialists such as respirology or dysphagia as a major concern, referral to GI simultaneously? Would you recommend that?
Yeah, we're fortunate with our multidisciplinary ALS clinics that usually there is an individual with expertise in that area, so it's not necessary. I think I know the 16 clinics and I know the investigators pretty well there. The vast majority of them already have a respirologist associated with the clinic and a speech language pathologist. So usually it's not necessary. All that being said, if a patient is having a lot of difficulty with swallowing or a lot of breathing difficulties and there's any delay at all, then you're right. Then it does make sense to send those to local experts first while they're waiting for their appointment for the ALS clinic.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. Dr. Zimmern, could you tell us or give us an example of a complex ALS case from your practice that demonstrates some of the points we've just chatted about?
Yeah, I think some cases worth discussing, and we've sort of touched on this a bit, is those patients with progressive arm or leg weakness who have minimal sensory symptoms. Quite often, remember, this is an older population, people in their 60s and 70s for the most part. Quite often, when you do the MRI of the spine, degenerative changes are seen in the cervical spine or the lumbosacral spine. And then the thinking is, well, the arm must be weak, even though the patient doesn't have any sensory symptoms, because of the arthritic changes in the neck. Those patients frequently go for surgery. And then postoperatively, the orthopedic or neurosurgeon notices that, I'm not sure why that arm continues to get weak despite decompression of the cervical spine or lumbosacral spine. So quite often we'll see a patient who was told they had cervical lumbosacral disease as a cause of their weakness, and then it turns out it was actually ALS, and they just had a common pathology, which is arthritic changes in their neck or lower back. So I think those are the ones that are really challenging. Patients who have arm or leg weakness, minimal sensory symptoms, but have abnormalities on their neuroimaging. When is it from the degenerative changes, and when is it from a neurodegenerative condition like ALS? And we have some tricks where we can sort that out using EMG. There are certain clues we can see on examination. So those are the patients that I would really look out for if you're not certain that the changes can account for the degree of weakness. Another population of patients worth highlighting are patients who present with cognitive impairments. Rarely, ALS can present with something called frontotemporal dementia. It's a spectrum of disease where patients can have cognitive impairment and motor neuron disease. So some patients actually will present with cognitive difficulties. It's usually more difficulties with executive function, language, affect, so behavioral changes, less memory and disorientation like is in Alzheimer's disease. So these patients went with frontal cognitive abnormalities, and then they develop progressive weakness. So while they're seeing their cognitive neurologist, an astute neurologist will notice that their arm isn't moving as well as it should, or their speech is a little bit slurred. So those are complicated patients that start with frontal type impairments and then develop ALS. So those are some of the more challenging populations of subgroups, I should say, of patients that we're sometimes challenged to diagnose.
So that point's well taken of the patients with cognitive impairment. It is a neurodegenerative disorder. It's certainly something to also watch out for, I guess, as a red flag as part of the referral process when we're first triaging patients as well to see if there's any cognitive changes that come about, because that's not always well noted when the patient's evaluated initially as well and diagnosed with ALS. So it's a good point.
That's exactly right.
When we suspect it and start to make a referral, of course, it sets alarms for patients and families if we refer to the ALS Neuromuscular Clinic and haven't had that discussion with the patient yet. What should we be telling our patients at this point? How can we best discuss this potential diagnosis with our patients?
I think this is a really important point to bring up because every community neurologist obviously has a different style and different comfort level of what to discuss with a patient where they suspect ALS. I think you're right. Nowadays, with Google, patients are going to type in the doctors they refer to, and if they see that they're involved in care of ALS patients and that wasn't brought up in the discussion, that can be very alarming. But on the other side of the coin, I think it's important not to get too into the details of the disease because there are so many variants and variability in the rate of progression. So I think it is important to say to patients, look, there is some weakness, and there's a number of conditions that can cause progressive weakness in arm or leg or speech difficulties. On one of the disease on the list of possibility is ALS. And I'm going to be sending you to some experts in ALS and neuromuscular diseases to help sort out what the cause of this is. I think that's critical for patients to know that it's a possibility, but also know that there are other investigations that are key. And every year in the ALS clinic, we will pick up some mimickers to highlight that point further. I think we really have to stay away from getting into discussions about timelines. Certain patients have frequently complained to me that a community neurologist told them to get their affairs in order. Those type of discussions I don't think are appropriate in the earliest phase of the disease. So I think it's best to do exactly what you recommended, to bring it up, let them know it's a diagnostic possibility, but there are other possibilities as well. And you're being referred to the ALS Neuromuscular Clinic to have this further evaluated. The other thing I have to say is really important with ALS clinics is our waiting lists are very short. We intentionally keep the waiting lists in the neighborhood of, you know, less than 4 weeks because we understand this is a very difficult time for patients.
So then once our patients are referred to the ALS Neuromuscular Center, what should they expect?
Yeah, the first thing we do when patients are referred is we do a very long assessment looking at all the investigations that were done. Obviously, we do a thorough history and examination. And sometimes we'll order some additional testing, some additional EMG tests to see how it's changed or progressed over time. Once the diagnosis is confirmed, we spend a lot of time with patients sitting down, discussing the diagnosis. You know, it's important they understand the disease, how it progresses. But the first thing we do is we reassure them that we're not going to abandon them. These patients have been in limbo for about a year, sometimes 2 years, knowing that there's something wrong with their body. And they want, there is almost a sense of relief to know that, number one, we finally have a name of the disease. The beast has a face, and the name of the beast is ALS. And to know that they're not going to be abandoned, we're going to stick with them throughout the course of the disease. And sometimes I describe to them, we'd sort of become like the new family doctor. We'll be seeing you every, you know, very frequently. And if there are any issues, there's a whole team to assist. Well, you know how they say it takes a village to raise a child? Well, it mm-hmm. certainly takes a village to look after a patient with ALS. And ALS clinics are fantastic, not necessarily because of the clinicians, more because of the allied health professionals that are associated with the clinic. And I described to them the interdisciplinary team that's going to be looking after them, the speech-language pathologist, the dietitian, the occupational therapist, the respirologist, the RT, palliative care experts, physiatry, our nurse manager. So there's a whole group of experts specifically with specific skills tailored towards managing the care of ALS. And I think there's some comfort in patient hearing that it's a whole team that's going to be following them through the course of this disease. And then I also discuss clinical trials and research. And I think that's key because research is hope. And patients have to understand that despite this being a terminal disease that presently we don't have a medication that can stop it, there are so many clinical trials underway, and there really is a palpable sense of momentum right now in the ALS community that we are going to find new therapies, hopefully in the near future. So we reassure them that we are not going to abandon them. We tell them about the multidisciplinary team and support system in place. And then we tell them about the research studies and try to enroll them into our clinical trials.
I think that's certainly very important. I think the stressing the fact that it's a multidisciplinary approach, especially when we're referring the patient, is certainly going to be a very helpful key tool to address with the patient and the family, especially once the diagnosis has been confirmed at your end. These patients, like you said, have been, you know, having symptoms for so long with no diagnosis, and their families go through so much. I think when they get to you clinically and both psychologically, I think it's going to be very important for them to know that they're not alone in the journey, and they have a huge team following them. So that becomes really important.
I think I'm glad you brought that up because this isn't just a disease of the patient. It's a disease of the whole family. There's no question about it. And as challenging as it is to look after ALS patients, boy, it's what a real privilege is to see the best in human nature. I can't tell you the number of times I've just been in awe by friends and family members who just step up and just do the wonderful, most wonderful caring things for their loved ones. So it's really a testament to the human spirit that when someone is diagnosed with a disease this severe, you see the best in human nature, and it's incredible what we see in terms of family support. We also understand that sometimes this can be overwhelming for family members, and we are able to set up home care services for patients or even respite care so family members can get a break to make sure that they don't neglect their own health.
We've discussed the diagnostic delays in ALS occurring at the primary care level. What can we as community neurologists do to help close the diagnostic gap with the general practitioners in the community?
You know, I think this is probably the most important question, because when we look at that diagnostic delay from symptom onset to diagnosis of about 1.5 to 2 years, the main delay is getting from the primary care physician, the general practitioner, to that first neurologist. Once they're at that first neurologist, the diagnosis is usually relatively short, in the neighborhood of months. And the reason is, number one, early on in the course of the disease, it's not obvious. It's very challenging. It's only in one limb or in the speech areas, and there's a whole bunch of things that are much more common, that are much more likely to cause those symptoms than something like ALS. Remember, ALS is a rare disease, only 2 to 3 per 100,000. So family physicians are only going to see a handful of cases throughout their career. So it's not going to be the first thing they should think of when a patient comes in with arm weakness. Things like an ulnar neuropathy, carpal tunnel, or cervical spine disease would be much more common. But of course, we hope they remember those red flags. And if there's no sensory symptoms and it's just weakness and wasting, that's the kind of patient that really needs to refer to a neurologist. So I think it's important that family physicians, although this being rare, that they be aware that this disease is out there and they will see this disease in their careers. Increasing awareness is the key, and that's why I'm happy we're doing this podcast today. We got a big boost in awareness from the Ice Bucket Challenge, where people finally understood what this disease was and how bad it is. In fact, I remember diagnosing a patient after the Ice Bucket Challenge with ALS and asked them if they've ever heard of ALS, and they said no. And then they pause and say, wait a sec, is this the ice bucket disease? So it's amazing how that has really increased awareness and people are more vigilant now at the possibility. I think it's also critical for community neurologists when they're doing their CME events to make sure that neuromuscular diseases like ALS is highlighted. Again, not just because it's a rare disease, but mainly because it is a devastating disease, and these diagnostic delays are problematic. The later a patient gets to a neurologist, the later they'll get to an ALS clinic, the less likely they'll qualify for a clinical trial, and the more likely they'll have advanced disease and be less responsive to medications.
Well, Dr. Zinman, this has been very insightful and educational. It's certainly given us a lot to think about in terms of practice-altering measures. Are there any final thoughts or tips when it comes to the diagnosis of ALS?
I think it's worthwhile remembering that of course ALS is a rare but is a devastating neurological disease, and all neurologists and even primary care physicians are going to see this disease in their careers. There are major diagnostic delays in getting a patient from symptom onset to an ALS clinic of 1.5 to 2 years. And the sooner we can get these patients to ALS clinics, the sooner we can start treatments, the sooner we can get them in their clinical trials. So, like any neurodegenerative condition, the sooner we diagnose this, the better it is. Last, I'd like to say that brighter days do lie ahead for patients with this disease. We are advancing in terms of understanding the disease, development of biomarkers to make it an easier diagnosis, and I'm happy to say that there's been an acceleration in clinical trials for both the familial and sporadic forms of the disease. So there's no question one day we'll be able to say, I'm sorry, you've been diagnosed with ALS, but I have a medication that's going to stop progression of this disease. And that day cannot come soon enough.
Well, thank you, Dr. Zinman. Thank you for your time today and all the insight you've provided. If you're looking for more information or resources on ALS, visit ALSpathways.ca. While there, feel free to suggest any additional topics of interest you'd like us to cover in future podcasts. We read all suggestions and take everything into consideration. Once again, my name is Dr. Pinto, and this has been ALSpathways.ca Healthcare Provider Podcast Series. Thank you for listening.